Welcome to Tech It to the Limit, the humorous and surprisingly informative podcast that makes digital innovation in healthcare as entertaining as it is relevant. I'm Sarah Harper.
And I'm Elliot Wilson. And we're here to pull back the curtain on the world of digital transformation in healthcare.
Don't worry, you don't need a medical degree to join in on the fun. Just a sense of humor and a penchant for all things health tech.
So buckle up, folks. It's time to
Tech It to the Limit.
What's up, Elliot?
What's up, Sarah? And welcome to, sadly, the last episode of Tech It to the Limit for this season.
Yeah, thanks, listeners, for tuning in for a third season. And don't be sad, be glad, because we're going to be back for a fourth season to be announced in 2026. Keep your ear to the headphones.
Keep your ear to the pods. To the pods?
To the pod waves. Yeah, so let's focus on the here and now. Let's live
yes.
in the now.
As,
what
as
do we got going on
say,
this month? Mm-hmm.
Enjoy the wow that's happening now, right?
Yes.
Thank you, Daniel Tiger.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. What's happening now? We just got back, or I just got back from health, which was incredible. There were so many amazing conversations around digital health tech. We had some spicy nugs conversations with a few different folks. We recorded a lot of content trolling around mm-hmm. the different sessions and the exhibit floor and the parties. So we're going to be putting all that together for you all, and hopefully you'll get that out to you very soon. Really excited to bring that all to you. But I wasn't the only one traveling since our last episode, Sarah. You went global.
I did go global, although not for the pod, unfortunately, not yet. I went on a personal trip with my eldest daughter to Germany to visit friends and also to Switzerland. So that was fantastic. And like every trip with children, there's always a health scare. And so I got to experience firsthand how primary care
works. Wait, everybody's okay, right?
Everybody's just fine. Yeah.
Oh, good.
It was a COVID/strep situation that was resolved rather quickly by getting into a same-day appointment with a pediatrician in Germany.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you didn't have to wait in ridiculously long lines like the propaganda says you have to?
I know. You know what? The access was quite phenomenal. And I will say it was a really interesting lesson. Like, oh, huh. Okay. So it's not as bad as everybody says it is. But also the friend I was staying with actually happened to be a psychotherapist. And so I learned a lot about the care force side, at least from his perspective of working in Germany. That was really fascinating. And he was in the process of trying to buy a practice while we were there.
Huh.
And talk about nepotism. He was being mentored by the person who was retiring. And there were all these people jockeying for the license because they do control, the government issues licenses to folks in order so that they can stand up their own
to have a practice.
Psychotherapy practice. Yeah, you can't just go out and like start your own practice. And it was really fascinating. So he was having to like play this game of politics to try to woo the person with the license so that when they retired, he got the practice. Really fascinating stuff.
Reminds me of like liquor licenses in cities here in the US. Like they only have so many, and you've got to like, if you want to open a bar, you've got to kind of like destroy another bar to get theirs.
Yeah. You know, there were some pros and cons to the system. All in all, I would say it was a really fascinating experience. Didn't unfortunately get to experience health tech. We used a phone to be able to make the appointment. But yeah, it was all good.
It's kind of standard at this point.
Pretty standard. Telephone. You know, telephonic medicine. But anyway, speaking of global, we have a really exciting guest on the show today. Elliot, do you want to tell our listeners who we have the privilege of interviewing?
Yeah, this is very exciting. Mm-hmm. Big get for the season finale of Tech It to the Limit here. We've got Dr. David Rue, who is the global chief medical officer of Microsoft. What? So one of the
Wait, did you say, I'm sorry, did you say Microsoft?
Yeah, Microsoft. You know, one of the three owners of all of our data in the world, between them, right. AWS and Google, right?
Better
Everything
be nice.
Runs through them. So really fascinating conversation with him. He is, for a guy who is this clinical leader for this massive organization, this massive global organization, the man is so down to earth.
Yeah, he was super chill.
Yeah, really relaxed and very conversational. It was really fun to talk with him. So after the break, we'll be interviewing him, and you get to hear some of his perspectives, which I think are rather unique. But before we get into that, I think we have some fun to have beforehand. What do you say, Sarah?
Hell yeah. I need a little spice in my life, something to pick me up. Speaking of data, you know, critical to successful data corporations is the element of trust, right? Mm. Consumer trust in your stewardship of their data. So when we come back, we will be debuting a brand new game called Trustometer. So stick around. We'll be right back.
This episode of Tech It to the Limit is sponsored by Algorithm Align, the dynamic values interface for healthcare technology leadership. Built for your next pitch to CMIOs, CFOs, and that one board member who still uses a Palm Pilot. Algorithm Align lets you adapt your algorithm's mission statement in real time, depending on who's asking. Talking to the FDA? It's about safety. Pitching to investors? Scale and stickiness. Presenting at an equity summit? Suddenly, it's all about fairness and bias mitigation, baby. Algorithm Align doesn't just pivot, it pirouettes. And this holiday season, we're offering the exclusive Moral Flexibility Toolkit, including talking points pre-approved by public relations. 3 nebulous but sleek heat maps, interpretable however the board wants. And 1 tear-jerking patient story, fully anonymized and entirely hypothetical, just like your commitment to equity. Now through Black Friday, buy 1 ethical framework and get the second one half off with the promo code MissionFlex. Some restrictions and internal contradictions apply. Algorithm Align, because when your values are abstract enough, they scale.
Welcome back, listeners. It's time for your favorite part of every Tech It to the Limit episode. The time after the commercial break, when the show is still going on. We are going to be introducing a new game today. It's called Trustometer. It's November, the season of casseroles, or hot dishes, as we call them here in the Midwest. Cranberry sauce, hopefully not from a can. And questioning your trust in, well, everything.
I'm questioning my trust in you. The best cranberry sauce comes from a can.
Oh my
jelly,
God. I
where
feel
you
like
have to like shake
the
it out.
Great American debate. Yeah. It makes like that weird noise when it comes out. Yeah. Ew.
Well, your relatives, your airline, and your electronic health record, nothing says gratitude like system alert overload with a side of unstructured data.
Ooh, yes. Today, we are playing Trustometer, listeners. We're going to share real health tech scenarios, and Elliot and I are going to rate our trust in them from 1 to 10.
Yeah.
So like Elliot, explain this Likert scale. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so, I love how you call it a Likert scale because
I know,
you know it's very scientific here.
Yes, very. Sorry.
One is like a Motorola cell signal in a hospital stairwell, you know, in the sub basement.
Yeah. Piss poor. Okay, got it. And 10 is like my grandmother's green bean casserole, which, by the way, has no cream in it. It's hot.
What?
It's consistent. It's always on time. Yeah, I know. Can you believe it? We're a heart-healthy family.
I want to come have Thanksgiving dinner at your house.
I know, right? You're like, I want my canned food and my cream. Hit me.
So we're gonna give like a little bit of a scenario, talk it through. Mm-hmm. These are real life scenarios, and we're gonna rate it from 1 to 10. So first up, the Epic Sepsis Prediction Model that first debuted back in 2021, where researchers at the University of Michigan reported in JAMA, Internal Medicine, that real-world performance was modest. The area under the curve was around 0.63. And clinicians would need to chase roughly 100-plus alerts to help one patient meaningfully earlier. And so again, that's according to JAMA. We got the links in the in the show notes. What do you think, Sarah?
Ooh, I mean, that's useful in theory, right? Sepsis is definitely a problem that all hospitals are trying to solve, but it sounds like the solution is kind of noisy in practice. When your alert feed sounds like my toddler smashing the doorbell, you kind of tune out.
Yeah, classic alert fatigue. I'm giving it like a one.
Yeah, I'll say 1.5, maybe potential with serious tuning and some guardrails in place.
I don't know. I feel like 2021 also feels like a long time ago. I feel like we've evolved since then.
Right. Yeah. Let's hope. All right. Scenario number two, Practice Fusion paid $145 million after the DOJ said that it misrepresented some EHR capabilities and took kickbacks to influence a clinical decision support alert toward more opioid prescribing. Gross.
Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah. Decision support, more like decision distort. Am I right? No, that's a one for me. That's why transparency matters so much.
Yeah. Zero. I'm going with a zero. I know that's not part of our scale, but I'm making it. If your alerts are secretly sponsored and they're driving the opioid epidemic, we're out.
Yeah. No
All
bueno.
Right. Let's bring some
Next
positivity back. Yeah.
All right. Next Gen Healthcare and their $31 million settlement over allegations that capabilities were misrepresented and a test-only setup helped to pass certification. Great in the lab, not in the wild. And that is from the Department of Justice.
Ooh. Okay, a stunt double EHR looks great in the trailer, stumbles on the first step. What would you give it?
Ooh, I'm keeping it low here. You gotta, you know what though? Actually, I'm gonna give it like a 2.53 because one, buyer beware. And two, I've worked for enough startups to know, although not that Next Gen Healthcare is like a startup, but like I've worked with enough health tech companies to know that sometimes you kind of have to fake it till you make it. And very oftentimes product is right on the heels of what sales is telling the customers they're capable of doing. So I got to cut a little bit of slack. I mean, they got penalized $31 million for it. So, you know, hopefully they learned their lesson.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm going to go for a 1.1 for sticking the landing absolutely nowhere. All right, we're back on Sepsis Watch. Sounds like Baywatch. Sepsis Watch. A brighter spot, okay? At Duke, Sepsis Watch paired an AI model with nurses as the interpretive layer. Good job having humans in the loop.
Yes.
Trust came from the workflow. Nurses triaged alerts and delivered context to physicians. That sounds promising. That's in Journal of Medical Internet Research, Medical Informatics, and an ethnography from Data and Society on the human work behind it. I love that there's dual publications on this. Elliot, what do you get?
I love it. Humans in the loop. What a trust builder for the deployment of AI. So not in the loop, not an afterthought. 7 out of 10.
Ooh, 7. I like it. I'm going to go with the 7 as well. The math mattered, but the handoffs really built trust. Good job.
That's right.
Sepsis Watch.
Sepsis Watch. Machines make health more human. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Sounds like a t-shirt to me.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to make that t-shirt. I'm going to do that.
There's still time. Get your iron out.
All right, on the finance side, many revenue cycle teams use credit bureau information for propensity to pay to score and tailor their outreach. Like Experian Health explains how it works in a link that we'll share. And for policy context, this is why access and transparency still matters. So what do you think?
If it's strictly about payment plans and it's clearly explained, maybe like a 3, but that second nudge about care decisions, definitely a 0. No question.
Yeah, I think you guys maybe like a cautious 2, right? You know, I get the need and I get the impetus behind it, but that needs some sunlight and some breathing room and some consent.
Yeah, it sounds like a field day for like a local news channel right there, if that story got out. All right. Next scenario, chatbots in 2025. Ooh, this is a current one. Mount Sinai researchers tested bots using made-up diseases. Ooh, I would love to know what those were. How much fun would that be to read? The bots confidently produced fake symptoms and treatments. Convincing tone, wrong facts. Sounds a lot like ChatGPT. Yeah. That's Mount Sinai Newsroom. We'll include the link in the show notes. What do you think, Elliot?
So having certainly come up with our own symptoms using bots ourselves, like I can totally get it. So I'm going to go with like a 2-3. It depends on what they're using it for, right? If you ideate with it, then verify it with real sources and real disease states and things like that, and your care team, I'm all for it. But if you're doing it just to see how well your bot performs, you're not doing it in real life. So 3.
Yeah, I agree with you. Kind of depends on the use case. Great drafting assistance, but it's not going to replace a human clinician. I'm going to go with a 1.
Oof, she's tough.
Yeah, I know. I'm harsh.
She's tough but fair. All right. Let's see. Let's switch over to imaging. All right. So AI can amplify over detection sometimes. So like when it surfaces tiny findings on uncertain significance that then launch costly rabbit holes. Like, oh, we saw this little tiny change in pixelation that you wouldn't normally see under the human eye. And so now I'm going to go send you for a whole bunch of other tests, right? Mm-hmm. So JAMA Health Forum had lessons from a computer-aided detection, and their reviews argue that AI should reduce overdiagnosis, not fuel it, right?
Yeah, that's the goal for sure. But just because we can find it doesn't mean we should treat it. Actually, but just because we can find it, it doesn't mean it's treatable or that there's even a problem at this stage, right? So
that's
I would say 3 until we can see clear clinical benefit, and that would be measured in 2 forms. 1, patient outcomes, you know, early detection leads to better outcomes, we hope. But 2, that we're not driving unnecessary burden for clinicians, right? Like, who's going to respond to all of these new results, right?
Yeah, 100%.
We already have an access issue in a lot of practices.
Right. Like the fact that like people have to remember that the human body is weird and lumpy and things are always wrong with it. And totally gross. And like there's tons of things that are going wrong in your body right now that you will never know. And if we start overanalyzing everything in our bodies, it will be like paralysis through analysis.
Totally. I think. Yeah, yeah. The system shut down.
2.5. Give me thresholds. Give me in governance. Give me, you know, regulation on this. Make it shared decision making and focus, like you said, on outcomes data. So that's where I'm at.
All right. I like the precision here. 2.5. All right. Let's move on to Alarmageddon. Alarms in the ICU. According to AHRQ Patient Safety Network, nearly 100% of ECG alarms are false or clinically insignificant. Translation,
what
the soundtrack is alert. Everything's fine. This person has a heartbeat.
Everything's fine. You don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
Just wanted you to know.
You're still doing fine over here. Yeah. So we're just going to say a 1-ish. I feel like that's generous.
Boom,
better
boom,
design,
zero.
Maybe, Mike Lime. Let's fine tune.
No, absolutely. I'm a 0. So, like, just as for context, right? I work with a company that tries to do alerting based off of some ambient technology, and they're shooting for no less than 85% true positive, right?
Right.
And here we're talking about an 89% false positive rate. It's useless. Right? It's useless.
Yeah, that's like my kid's science experiment. Okay, you might want to go back to Target and get some more poster board and start over, okay?
Yeah. Next up, we're on Fast and the Furious model drift.
Fast and the Furious.
Predictive models age. They grow older. Their bodies change. Their coding change. Populations shift. Workflows evolve. Performance of these models degrade over time if you don't monitor them and retrain them. And there's plenty of PubMed reviews out there on temporal degradation, which is a totally awesome band name.
Sounds like what's happening to my body every year.
Yeah, temporal degradation.
Yeah.
Millennials. So what do you think?
Set it and forget it has never been the way to go with AI. It certainly works for rotisserie chickens at Costco, okay? But this is a hospital. So I'm going to go with a 3 if we have a dedicated calibration Friday.
Listen, I can't even take my Subaru Forester that far without a little bit of a tune-up. You gotta give your AI some tune-ups. Your models need some tune-ups. So I'm gonna keep it. I'm gonna keep it right around the same, around 3.
Yeah,
not the worst.
There's so many analogies we could whip out here. You got to nurture your relationships. You got to date your husband, okay?
Got to date your bod.
You got to date your bod, okay? Or it's going to get dated fast. All right, last but not least, the great data hostage crisis. Even in the fresh year of 2025, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is having to crack down and tighten on information blocking rules to help force better access. So patients and clinicians are no longer hitting friction spots when it comes to sharing their medical data. Isn't that sad that we're still having to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. Like it's a feature at this point, right? It's a hostage situation, you know?
Give me my data.
The things that you got to do to get your data. So just release the discharge summary and step away from the roving workstation.
All right. It is a. So I'll say a 1 until export actually means export as structured, portable, shareable data. Yeah. I don't think we're going to get past this this crisis.
No, I know. And I mean, listen, if you want to make it harder, at least let me download it on a 3x5-inch floppy, you know? At least that'll maybe help protect it and prevent me from using it in other systems if you really feel that strongly about it.
3x5. Do they even make them as 3x5s?
No, 3.5-inch. Did I say 3x5? I meant 3.5-inch
floppy.
Yeah, that's
another photograph. That's another retro reference. All right. Well, can you trust health tech? Yes, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Trust shows up where workflow, evidence, transparency, and humans, ding, 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 meet up.
Yeah. Well, listeners, thanks so much for listening to our game, The Trust-O-Meter. And next up, we've got Dr. David Rue from Microsoft on Oculomics, Responsible AI, and whether pop-up alerts are a symptom or the disease itself.
Welcome back to Tech It to the Limit, listeners. Really excited to have with us today Dr. David Rue as a guest on the show. Dr. Rue is Microsoft's Global Chief Medical Officer and VP of Healthcare, a kind of digital double helix, blending medical insight with tech innovation. He's led pandemic response initiatives with the World Health Organization and the CDC, and he's helped stand up vaccine infrastructure. He holds 6 tech patents for embedding clinical decision support in EHRs because, you know, pop-up alerts don't solve practice variation. Before joining Microsoft, Dr. Rue served as the CMO for Samsung and Zinx Health, and he now advises a who's who of health policy and tech boards from the FDA to AdvaMed to Cedars-Sinai. He's also an adjunct professor at Stanford, which sounds relaxing if you ignore the rest of his LinkedIn. If there's a future where AI actually helps clinicians and doesn't just throw up alerts, Dr. Rue is probably coding the blueprint. So welcome, Dr. Rue. May I call you David?
Yes, please call me David. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you, David. We are a humorous and pretty informal podcast about digital transformation in healthcare, and we always like to keep things light and fun when we start our interviews. So wondering if you could share with us, what is your favorite dad joke? I know you have some kiddos at home. So what's a way that you like to annoy them after a long day at the office?
All right, so I'm going to tell more of a dad story, but it's still funny,
and,
at least to my kids who like to make fun of me. So a few years ago when my kids were around 13 and 11, we went to this all-you-can-eat Korean barbecue. And I don't know if you've ever been to one of those places, but they have a lot of really good food. So, you know, we just kept it coming. And I remember just feeling completely stuffed. And when the waitress at the very end came around and said, "Do you guys have room for dessert?" And so like my first instinct was, you know, I said, no, but I just kept on going on. I don't know why I kept on explaining. It's like, oh, I'm so stuffed. I couldn't eat another bite. I think I'm going to explode. I feel like, oh, this is too much. And then my son asked, is this going to cost more or extra? And she goes, oh, no, it's all part of your package or your bill. And I'm like, You know what? Actually, I think I have a little bit more room here. I don't know. It's weird. I think I could probably eat that dessert, you know? And so like, anyways, my kids just, they keep on making fun of me for the fact that I just flipped my script like so quickly.
Yeah.
Doesn't cost anything but calories.
Right? Some utilization controls at that dinner, it sounds like, you know? Yeah. You got a little moral hazard going on.
So I'm going to kick us off with like the first like serious question of, the day, good. David, if that's all right.
Yeah.
So, and thank you for sharing that story. I've been in that position many a time where just might burst with one more bite. So you went from treating patients to treating systemic inefficiencies at one of the biggest tech companies in the world. What was the aha moment, or maybe even more to the point, the breaking point that pushed you to trade the white coat for the cloud?
So my journey, as I've shared with many folks, is sort of like the Hobbit, an unexpected journey, because I don't feel like I even anticipated when I was a med student or even before then that I would be going into a career in tech. Although I did major in computer science before when I was an undergraduate, and my thesis was AI in healthcare. So I actually kind of had some idea, but honestly, back then, no one really cared about it. And I didn't think that this would be anything relevant. I just did it more for fun. But what happened was I was spending a lot of time looking at how care was being delivered. And I just noticed that there's a lot of variation in care. And I always wondered, why is it that there was so much variation? And so I began to study it, and I realized a lot of it was unwarranted. And then I started trying to find ways to close those gaps and try to find ways to become more standardized on what we call evidence-based practices. And I started building some systems. And one of those was a product that ultimately became a company, and it was acquired by Cerner. So that kind of like got me into this process of working in health tech as well as seeing patients. But I think the one tipping point was really in my academic career when I was an ID fellow, and I was still trying to debate whether I wanted to go into academics or I wanted to go into industry. I actually decided at the time I was going to go into academics. So I applied for something called a VA Career Development Award. And the project that I submitted was something to make my life a lot easier, because I got a lot of phone calls or pages for antibiotic approvals. And I always thought, boy, that's just kind of really inefficient. So what I thought I would do is I'd actually create a website, our internet site. And so anyone that wanted an antibiotic approval within the hospital or health system would go to this internet site. They would actually click on the guideline, and then they would put the patient name, and it would be automatically approved. And there'd be a note documenting that it was approved, and it was evidence-based, and it allowed me to sleep at night. So I thought that was like the best for everyone. But we got this response back from the central office that said, well, if you're going to need to do this, you're going to have to get consent from every patient. And I said, well, that's impossible. You can't. I mean, right now, when I get antibiotic approvals, I don't consent patients. But they're like, well, you're studying this. And so literally at that moment, I pivoted from academia to industry, because I realized
no more of that.
Too challenging to get through all of that. And I never looked back since then.
Oh, man.
I feel the innovation escaping from my grasp, right? Like, it's being pulled into this vortex of regulation and bureaucracy.
Yeah, bureaucracy, really.
Yeah. The joy has left my soul.
I remember when we were launching telemedicine for the first time in our acute facilities, right? And we were like, well, we need to have informed consent every time we do a telemedicine visit. I'm like, not when they walk through the hospital, slap it on the front end, and then you've got it for everybody.
Yes.
Like, and then of course, like the consent for everything started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as you walked in the door. And I can imagine that, you know, just slapping that onto the front end, you know, you consent for the possibility that you might automatically get oral antibiotics or IV antibiotics. I love it.
You came here and you trust us to treat you with the latest evidence. Right? Okay, good. Let's keep right. moving, right?
Exactly.
Oh, man. Just for our listeners' sake, you mentioned your thesis on AI and healthcare. What year was that? I mean, I'm not trying to date you or anything but I'm dying to know, like,
I'm
how long ago did you write
actually.
That?
Yeah, like, somebody just sent me this request to join YPO, which I guess stands for Young Professionals Organization or something of that sort.
Nice.
And I
got carded.
I actually wanted to show them that I actually have an AARP card.
Yes.
I'm outdated myself, so I can't do that. But anyways, yeah, it was in 1988.
Okay. Wow. Awesome. So, yeah, that is retro.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, the AI was like very ancient AI. I don't even really call it AI. There was a language called Lisp. We programmed it. It was really all about decision trees. So you had to kind of think of every single possibility when you're doing this. And so that was really the whole thing. You just kind of throw everything you could possibly think. And in fact, most of the things I worked on were video games. So it was you're in a room. There's the four doors. What would you like to do? And then you would have to anticipate that they would say certain phrases and it would kind of take you down a different path. It was like those books that, I don't know if you ever did.
Choose Your Own Adventure.
Yes.
Your Own Adventure.
Golden Age of Programming.
Exactly. Love those books.
Absolutely. I always cheated. Look to see, am I going to die on this page? No, I'm choosing the other side.
You're going to go the other way? Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, I've got another question for you, David. As you know, I'm sure you're here on this podcast and we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence, among other things. AI is getting all the buzz these days in every single industry. But in healthcare, implementation still feels like Windows 95, no offense. So what is Microsoft doing to bridge the gap between this hype around AI and the clinical reality on the ground?
Yeah, and I really appreciate this question because I do think that people sometimes think that the technology itself is going to solve all the problems, when the reality is you actually have to implement the technology, and getting it into workflows and getting people to adopt it and use it is not as easy as just simply making it available. A really good example is about 10 years ago, there were a lot of studies that were demonstrating the incredible potential of applying AI on a retinal image. It was something called oculomics. And they demonstrated that we could diagnose diabetic retinopathy, a whole bunch of other medical conditions. You could even determine a person's gender just by using AI on a common retinal image. And when I say retinal image, it's an eye image that every one of us has taken whenever you go see an eye doctor to get your eyes checked. It's what's captured. And so there was a lot of hope and excitement that this could transform healthcare. But what happened is that the amount of time it took for a clinician to capture that image was about 20 minutes. It was something that oftentimes the hand wasn't super steady, so the image quality wasn't great. We oftentimes found that, as the individuals did this, they just didn't have enough time in the day to do this, and they didn't get paid for it. So it's not surprising that it never really took off apart from just sort of these research studies. But very quietly, a lot of those barriers, in fact, all of those barriers have been removed. It's now a fully automated system. It only takes 2 minutes instead of 20. One other area was that oftentimes you needed to dilate the eyes 40% of the time. Now you didn't need to dilate the eyes. Didn't require any individual of clinical background or even a technologist to do this. You could just simply push a button and it does it. And there's a CPT code that allows for reimbursement. So you actually kind of had this new path for us to be able to deploy it. And so just recently, within the past month, we launched an initiative in collaboration with numerous other stakeholders. It's called the Alliance for Healthcare from the Eye. And what it is really, it's the real-world application of oculomics to try to find ways that we can improve care and improve access to care. And to give you an idea of how impactful this could be, the University of Texas shared some really compelling results. They were one of the first sites to start deploying this. And in East Texas, in one of the federally qualified health centers, the first 50 patients that they began, and they, by the way, this is something that when you walk into the clinic, just as part of routine vital signs, you just get is 2 minutes and just so it's not like you're needing to do anything special. It's just you're coming in, you're going to get your vital signs, you get the eyes checked. And the first 50 patients that they had that went through this process, 20% of them, one out of every five, had advanced stage or moderate to severe diabetic retinopathy requiring urgent evaluation.
Wow.
With hemoglobin A1C of about 10.5%, which means that their diabetes is out of control. Actually, many of these folks didn't even realize they had diabetes. And so what we're now seeing is that we can actually identify these, what I call ticking time bombs. These are individuals that if untreated in the next 3 to 5 years are going to lose vision. They may have a heart attack or a stroke or have some really bad complication. And we're finding these individuals and we're bringing them care. It's really exciting to be a part of something where we're now applying technology, making it real for people, and we're trying to, you know, find ways that we can expand access to care.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. I think that's awesome. And I love that, you know, the technology and the systems around that technology have advanced far enough to make this a viable option. And thus, you know, you take the takeoff of what we hope will be its adoption and implementation. But you mentioned that, like, you're treating this oculomics coming in as just part of your regular vitals. Everybody gets it as part of their regular vitals, right? I mean, that's how quick it is. That's how ubiquitous it should be. And it's got me thinking, the technology has enabled what is essentially a new vital sign. And I'm curious, from your perspective, do you see technology opening up other new vital signs that we wouldn't otherwise be capturing?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing it already. There right now are so many different technologies that are being used to change the way that clinicians interact with patients. So one of them is voice. When you just have a conversation with a patient, that entire conversation is not only transcribed, but is converted into a note so the clinician can have that note ready when they're finished, make a few edits, and then plop it right into the medical record. It saves everyone time. It's extremely efficient, and it's something that the patients enjoy because then the clinician can pay attention to them. So there's a lot of benefit to that. But in that same voice recording, there are now AI technologies that can analyze the way that you talk and determine, are you depressed? Are you stressed? Mm-hmm. Are you actually, mm-hmm. you know, feeling that you might have some anxiety? And that's the type of sort of quiet, we call ambient type of technology that allows us to go in the background and do things that we normally would not have done. We normally would have had to require that you fill out a survey or we ask you a bunch of questions about how you're feeling. It's mm-hmm. now just mm-hmm. how you say it. Like, it's the voice, the tenor, the strength. We also have a mechanism to determine if you, let's say you have asthma or you have COPD or you have certain other conditions, just by you talking, we can determine how your asthma is doing. And so we don't even need to do a lot of these tests. So the ability for us to determine how a person is doing and assess that can be done through so many mechanisms. And a lot of it are things that we could not have done with normal mechanisms, without normal tools that today are very either time consuming or very impractical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I foresee a future where people are waking up and they're saying hello to their smart home. And as they're, you know, giving commands to their smart home or adding things to their grocery list, those biomarkers in the voice recording are going, you know, getting sent up to the cloud, they're getting analyzed and coming back with diagnosis or recommendations, or, you know, in the long run, maybe, you know, releasing some chemicals into the home to pump up those, the serotonin.
Pump up the jams.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
Like, we've detected you need a disco party.
Right? And a babysitter.
Oh, I love it. I'm going to shift this a little bit, if that's all right,
yeah,
David.
Sure, yeah.
A very important topic for us here on this podcast, which is around health equity. We don't see it just as a moral imperative, but we see it as a systems problem. And given Microsoft's data infrastructure, how do you ensure that these tools that we create are used to dismantle structural bias and not reinforce it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we have to look at how bias is propagated. And oftentimes they come in ways that we didn't even anticipate. So, like, even in healthcare, you know, clinicians, we're not out there to try to propagate bias. We are there to try to treat the patients. But, you know, there are instances where some of the things that we do, we have inadvertently introduced bias. Like, the most classic example is when we were calculating renal function. We had a formula for doing that. And based on the formula, if you are African-American, we would adjust your numbers in such a way that it made it seem like, well, you really weren't that, they didn't have that bad a disease. And how did that get implemented? Well, ultimately, we knew that something was fishy when we started looking at the transplant list and we didn't see a whole lot of African-Americans because their GFRs weren't meeting the criteria. Mm-hmm. Well, clearly there was an issue here because we were introducing a formula that was based purely on race. It had nothing to do with the physiology or the metrics, the biology of the individual. It was just simply about, you know, the race. And we've now been, or you know, looking at ways to we can adjust it. So bias is actually present in at least three different areas. The first is just within the data itself. And again, when you are building a model and you're trying to build it on a data set, you're doing your best to try to make it as diverse as possible. But when you start deploying it in other populations, you're ultimately making an assumption that this person is just like that person. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case, especially when you go into underserved or we get into like other groups that there aren't as many individuals. That bias in terms of saying that this population that we originally studied it is the same as others has to be addressed. And the way we address that is we actually have to enable testing of these data sets or the models on local data sets or on diverse, very large data sets. And so that's like one of the areas that we see. As we talked about before, the models themselves may in fact have the biases because we're introducing variables and other things that on the surface seem like they're adjusting for a variety of factors. But the reality is, the reasons why we see race, gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic factors like zip code and others are because of social factors that have ultimately led to either decreased access to care or other things that were not measurable. And so we have to actually look and carefully look at the models themselves. And the last is really about how you apply it. We know that we can have models that ultimately get deployed in ways that are very unique or specific for populations and then exclude others. And so as we look to do this, it's really not so much just a Microsoft issue. This is really a societal issue. Have we put together the processes to enable that we have addressed biases in all these different areas and ensure that this is being done in a way that is fair for everybody?
I agree with you, David. One, I appreciate that you broke it down and you kind of zeroed in on the three different types of biases as you see them. I think that's a really helpful construct for our listeners. I agree with you that it's not just a Microsoft issue and it is a societal issue, but I think we all have a part to play, right? And there's that phrase, like when everybody's in charge, no one's in charge. When everybody's accountable, no one's accountable, right?
That's
and
right.
So I think it behooves us as individual entities and individual innovators to think about, well, what can I do within my organization strategy to make a difference? So is there anything specific that Microsoft is doing in the health equity space vis-a-vis AI that you want to highlight for our listeners today that you're really proud of?
Yeah, and you're touching on something that I think is really important, that we all have a shared responsibility to be able to ensure that AI is done responsibly. And one of the things that we saw pretty commonly when we spoke to a lot of our customers and our partners was that there were a lot of things you need to do to make AI, responsible AI, something that can be implemented. And so health systems, you know, being sort of on the front lines and delivering care, they have a very important responsibility to ensure that the care they deliver is equitable. It's something that is understandable. It's something that's repeatable. It creates value and all the key principles of responsible AI. So they're one of the first groups that said, we want to embrace responsible AI. We want to do it because we want to use AI. We see incredible potential. But the process of doing it is very time consuming. It requires a lot of people. It takes a long time. So like the process needs to be made super efficient, time, resource, and cost. And so as we started talking to folks about that, we realized that there's really three ways that we can approach this. One is, rather than relying on a whole bunch of people to do it, let's leverage technology. Let's try to create technology solutions that can enable more seamless testing of these models, that allow us to be able to monitor for the drift and the outcomes, that allow us to be able to assess for bias, that create a governance that process so that we know what models are out there and what are the characteristics of them. So these are all the kinds of things that we knew needed to be done, and technology can be done in a way that can help us streamline that. So that was the first area. But we've also come to realize that there's power in numbers. So if multiple organizations are all testing the same models, we can actually create a network that allows us to be able to share our findings so that we don't have to feel like we have to carry the world's burden of testing every single model, doing it all the things that we know are necessary, but maybe split some of that responsibility, a shared, you know, set of duties that each of us takes on. And so like that, I call that like the power of the network or collaboration. And the third is there a way that we can actually completely offload some of this so that, you know, maybe you don't have enough resources at all. Maybe you have a one-person IT department. It's impossible for you to do responsible AI, but you'd sure like to have the AI tested on models before they get to you. And so this then shifts a little bit of the burden to the technology companies and the model developers to be able to take on some of that. And it's really all these players working together, you know, in collaboration with the regulators and folks that are trying to ensure that this is done on a systematic basis to enable responsible AI. And so this group that is now kind of doing all this is called the Trustworthy and Responsible AI Network, or TRAIN. And TRAIN, it was launched in the United States last year. There's about 60 health systems that are a part of it. It's exciting. It's not just large health systems and academic centers, but it's also small rural hospitals and community-based centers. And this also taken on in Europe. A large number of sites in Europe have said, hey, we think this is extremely important. And their motivation is the fact that they want to get ahead of the regulators to be able to demonstrate this is how AI is done responsibly. And we collectively are going to try to find a way to do this.
That's awesome. I love that. Thank you for being a convener of tech companies and also health systems that are interested in solving these problems together globally. That's fantastic. Just to quickly dovetail on your response there, because I think you alluded to it earlier when you were talking about your initial project that kind of pivoted you from an academia path to one of industry, right?
Right.
How does Microsoft manage the tension between ethical caution and commercial velocity, right? Speed to market, especially in this fragile ecosystem of healthcare. Could you speak a little bit towards the right balance there, at least for your organization?
Yeah, I mean, internally, we have a whole series of rules and policies that we follow to ensure that AI is done ethically. We've tried to become forward thinking in this and share things that we're seeing that we think are concerning, because sometimes the technology is so powerful that if we were to just simply release it without having that foresight and thoughtfulness, we could envision bad things happening. And it's not so much that people themselves would, you know, would be doing bad things, but there are bad actors as well. And so what we have to do is we actually have to think about the bad actors using this in ways that would be harmful. We have to think about the good actors using it in ways that could have unintended side effects and unintended consequences. So there's a lot of things that we are looking at, because we want, at the end of the day, people to have trust in the AI. And the only way to do that is we have to ensure that what we launch and what we release is something that will meet the standards that we feel are appropriate, not only for our own business, but also for society. And this can only be done in collaboration with multiple stakeholders. So we have our own kind of internal rules, but then we also work in collaboration with other groups to try to define what is it that we'll be doing in different areas. So we see differences in the way that AI is being applied and regulated and managed in the US versus in Europe versus in other parts of the world. And we know that each has sort of their own idea of like what is the most appropriate balance. And that's our goal. Meet clients and our customers and our partners where they're at, find ways that we can work together.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it was Edwards, was it Deming, who said, if you can't describe what you're doing as a process, you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't expect you to share like, you know, the nitty gritty, you know, secret sauce of Microsoft here for our listeners. But just the fact that we have a process and we follow it every time, you know, that's key to building trust and consistency and quality over time in your product. So
and we've also been releasing like some of the things that we've been using, for instance, like we call these safeguards, where we look for hallucinations in large language models. You know, we internally use this as a tool for our own QA. And now we have released this to our customers and our partners so that they can use this as they start building their models. So, you know, part of what we're doing is we're building the internal tools and releasing them as external tools.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to switch gears again. I'm just switcher tonight. One of the things that I think about constantly as we become more digital as a species
And as we compile more and more of our information and generate more and more of our information, which is stored more and more on cloud networks, when you tie that to our natural capitalist nature, we have consolidation in the marketplace, right? And so we have consolidated essentially to three major players, GCP, AWS, and Microsoft in the cloud space, right? I mean, we have three behemoths of industry kind of essentially in control of global health data infrastructure. And I wonder, like, where are the safeguards? Who's protecting the patient rights when you've got so many of these different companies, you know, putting their stuff out into the public cloud like that? What is Microsoft's strategy? Again, you know, not to get into the nitty gritty, but what does Microsoft do to ensure that that trust with the just the storage and sanctity of that data?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start with the storage and the sanctity and the ability for us to make sure that people feel confident that the data is being managed in a way that protects it. I think that's a foundational element of any type of approach. You need to make sure that, you know, your foundation is solid. And, you know, there's been a significant amount of effort where we've been spending time to try to build that out and enable cybersecurity protections. We've also expanded that capability where we launched programs where we could provide cloud access for cybersecurity to rural hospitals. And, you know, that is something that we knew, while, you know, there's tremendous value in having cloud and with the cybersecurity protections that you can have, you need to have the ability to actually pay for it. And some sites don't even have that. So we wanted to make this more democratized in a way that we would allow for that to happen. And so that's I'll call it a foundational element. There's been a significant amount of effort to need, you know, where we've been looking at trying to build out that capabilities to go above and beyond your storage and compute, because a lot of these models now are starting to require more and more capabilities. And, you know, obviously for us, it's been, you know, big investments into data centers and finding ways that we can make them more, you know, efficient and sustainable from an environmental perspective. There's so many things that we can do around that space that we're leaning in on. I think a lot of the attention is now being applied on the data as well. We're starting to realize that the data needs to be something that needs to be properly managed. And that means it has to be something that people can access it, you know, through different modalities. So leveraging open standards and other ways that people can, with APIs and other means to be able to access. And in particular, patients having the ability to be able to download and have access to their own information on whatever devices they want using those interoperability standards. And so we've embraced that. And that's part of what we do to try to make sure that data is more democratized as well as protected. But then there's this capability of AI on top of it. And this is where I think we're going to now start seeing tremendous changes in the way that we think about how this data is managed. In the past or in the current, it's largely based off of individuals saying, you know, can you just give me my medical record? Or can you just send me the information and get access? But when you get that, most people don't even know what it means. And so they end up just being sort of like an individual HIE. They like then send it to another person. But what we have now are AI systems that could potentially analyze it, and you could interrogate it. You could actually ask questions about your own medical record that would allow you to be able to truly understand that. And I think the more that people understand what they have in the records and what's going on, the more they can better protect themselves and they can better understand what and make better decisions. And so I think we're getting to the point of empowerment, you know, by creating that infrastructure, by enabling the interoperability, but now by giving it a mechanism for people can interpret it, where we're allowing patients to become better stewards of their own data. And that ultimately is going to be the best way to ensure that patient data and their rights are protected.
Quick follow-up on that. So I hear that and I say, okay, so Microsoft and their products, they've got this vision for that. But what about, is that something that you do or can enforce upon companies that
partner with you to put their products up on Azure, right? Is that something that you would take a moral stance as a company to say, hey, these are our principles around patient empowerment. If you want to put your stuff on Azure, you've got to be following this too. Or do you take a more laissez-faire kind of approach to that and say, I know, to me, there's a balance between business and morality there. And I'm curious as your stance on that.
Yeah. And so I really appreciate this question, because I'll use the Alliance for Healthcare from the Eye as an example. When we started looking in this space and we started seeing many companies start to develop these applications, what was happening is that one company would come to a hospital and say, oh, we've got this solution for diabetic retinopathy. Use this device and our data gets secured on our platform and, you know, we can then kind of have great benefits. And then another company might come in and say, oh, we've got this, mechanism to be able to look for this other condition. Maybe it's a cardiovascular disease. And then you got another company that says, oh, we've got another one that looks at, you know, chronic kidney disease. And then so on. And ultimately, as a consumer of that, as a health system that's trying to procure all this, you realize you've got too many systems out there and it's untenable, it's unmanageable. And so what we realized is that the best way is to focus first on the consumer patient health system experience. One image capture, one cloud, and multiple different AI vendors all working off of that same image. Now, to do that, it's been a lot of herding cats, because, you know, everyone started on their different paths, but we really said, hey, listen, if you want to participate in this, you're going to need to be an organization that is kind of working with us so that we can create a seamless experience for the end user. And on top of that, we are adding the requirement to say, if you're going to test and deploy, or you're going to deploy this within this system, we want you and we require you that you test this model on this very large data set, this diverse data set that will give us greater sense that this will actually work in this facility. And we want to continue to monitor that. It's our approach to doing what we talked about with responsible AI and train, where the technology provider takes on the responsibility. We want the technology providers to take on that responsibility so that the hospital systems, the health systems don't have to do that. And it's going to be particularly critical for rural and underserved communities that have no technology resources to do it. So by sort of like requiring that to be done, it also is great benefit for the technology developers as well, because they
build a better product.
Yeah, they can say, oh, we've tested it on this really diverse product. So it's a win-win for everybody. But you kind of need someone to say, well, here are the rules and here's how we work together and here's the environment. And that's kind of what I feel like we're doing right now, where we're kind of creating that new set of rules and environments.
And you've got the infrastructure and the scale to be the one in the room to say, hey, we're going to follow our rules on this, you know?
Yeah. And we're not forcing anyone to do it. If they wanted to go off and do their own thing, that's perfectly fine.
They
but
they
want to take advantage
else.
Of this. Yeah. They can partake.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier in the conversation, it's about evidence-based medicine. You're doing evidence-based AI in medicine, right? And so you have your set of standard practices that are proven to be more effective than others and increasing safety and value in the system. And it behooves someone to want to work with a partner like that, I think. So we're going to kind of put a bow on this awesome conversation that I wish would never end. My inner nerd's like, this could go on forever and it would just be heavenly. But we, our listenership sort of
straddles. We're on cloud nine.
Right. Oh, boom. Nice. Closing with a dad joke.
That's a dad joke.
Right? So our listenership kind of straddles the innovator space, like the health tech startup founder community, your CIOs, your CMIOs, and everyday practitioners, you know, clinical folks that are interested in digital transformation in their industry and they want to learn more about it. So kind of thinking about like your inner clinician and your inner health tech executive, what call to action would you have for both of those individuals, given all the excitement and also uncertainty in the future of our healthcare ecosystem?
Yeah. So the very first thing I need to let, I feel like I'm Paul Revere going out and letting people know, that something actually really exciting is happening, okay?
It's awesome.
So maybe not Paul Revere.
Maybe you're going to go on a Segway or a hoverboard,
because
a horse.
What's happening is we're starting to see a very important change in terms of how AI can impact our lives, and specifically in the space of knowledge workers. I think many people, when they saw AI, they thought it was going to impact, you know, like other machinists or assembly line folks and just do automation. But really what's happened is this, because of its ability to understand data, understand context, and now with agentic AI be able to do certain things, we're starting to see tremendous, amazing opportunities. So the first thing I would say is, let's not think about just sort of the common problems that we have today, but let's think of really big problems that can be solved by using AI. How do we increase access to care? How do we reduce costs? How do we improve and reduce the clinician burnout? How do we find ways to improve overall quality and safety and democratize care? How do we empower individuals with the knowledge to be able to do the right thing? These are amazing big ticket use cases that can finally be addressed with these new set of tools. And I would say, think big. I mean, start small, but think big. The second is, as we talked about before, none of this matters if people don't trust it. And so we have to make sure that these processes that we have embraced around responsible AI are operationalized, and we're doing it in a time, cost, and resource efficient manner. The things that I talked about with Train, every organization should be thinking about, how do I do AI at scale responsibly? So that's sort of that second piece. And the third is, we are moving so fast that we may be leaving behind an entire workforce. And if we don't think about how to skill and reskill that workforce so that they can take full advantage of this, we will unfortunately have resistance, and there's going to be a lot of people that will be unhappy, and we will lead to some major issues. The way I look at it is, AI can become a great tool to improve efficiency, but it can also augment care. And a lot of times people think that's sort of a binary decision, just, you know, do one or the other. But really, the very first question should be, look at the task. If it is a non-value-added task, it's something that you just say, this is so painstakingly difficult, time-consuming, and why am I as a human doing this? Then it's probably something that should be automated, and that task should no longer be around. And so think about ways that you improve that efficiency. But if it is something that, hey, the human's doing a great job, but we just don't have enough of those humans and we can't scale this, then we have to augment that. And the example I'll give is, one of my coworkers shared this in a public setting, so I can share this. He had an uncle that went to the ER, and in the ER, he had severe abdominal pain. He was complaining of, he died. He died in the ER of a burst aneurysm. Well, the CAT scan that showed that aneurysm before it had burst was in the queue to be read by a radiologist.
Oh, man.
Think about this.
Yeah. How,
what does it mean to augment care?
Oh,
it means to find a way that we can take AI and put it at the front of that queue, find the highest risk individuals and bring them
and
to
get
care.
Get in front of a person. Yeah.
And right. We don't want to replace the radiologist. We don't have enough of them. What we need to do is, we need 100, 1,000, and we need them everywhere. And that's what AI could do. And so we really do need to think how it can be applied and then skill people in terms of the proper use. And I kind of feel like those are the things that I wish people could do every single day, because what we would do is, we would actually find that the AI could create great benefit and people would adopt it.
Yeah. I really appreciate you talking through workforce upskilling and reskilling and potentially recareering when it comes to AI, because there's been this trend of people saying AI is not going to take away your job. And the fact of the matter is, there are some jobs that AI is going to take away in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And it may not always be clinicians. It may be some clinicians. And if we are going to hide our head in the sands and say it's not going to happen, I think we're doing the workforce a disservice, to your point.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate you calling that out, because that's not a take that tons of people are willing to take. So thank you for that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's how markets work, right? Like, we don't have there's not a job for somebody emptying my chamber pot anymore, right? Because we have toilets.
Wow, you don't have,
I don't
a, chamber
have a chamber pot,
pot. Cleaner?
I just want to be, like, right? I know, so passe.
Maybe I'm just bougie. Anyway, David, thank you so much for spending your evening with us at Tech Into the Limit.
So much.
We had an amazing time chatting with you and sharing your insights.
I appreciate it. And thank you for asking me fun and exciting questions. I don't normally get asked about dad jokes and other things. So anytime I can share some bad jokes, I'm happy.
Oh, awesome.
It is our pleasure. Well, listeners, stick around. We'll be right back.
Tech It to the Limit is brought to you by Unicorn Hunter. You know the drill. You're on the exhibit floor at Health, clutching your cold brew and your dignity, surrounded by startups all claiming to be the next big thing. That's why there's Unicorn Hunter, the world's first augmented reality investment algorithm that helps you spot billion-dollar founders before they finish saying AI-driven synergy. Just slip on the Unicorn Hunter vision lens and let the proprietary Mythic Match engine overlay a shimmering horn above companies statistically least likely to implode before Series B. Powered by sentiment analysis, pitch deck thermodynamics, and over 17,000 micro-expressions of chaotic good energy, Unicorn Hunter filters out the fluff so you can focus on the future. No more wasting time at booths selling AI for fax machines. No more nodding politely while somebody says patient-centric at scale. Just pure uncut deal flow. And for the truly adventurous, Unicorn Hunter Pro includes Vaporware Vision, highlighting founders who will ghost investors faster than your last due diligence request. Unicorn Hunter. Because in a world full of fairy tales and pitch decks, it pays to believe in better bets. Unicorn Hunter cannot guarantee returns, exit, or spiritual fulfillment. Side effects may include sudden FOMO, portfolio diversification, and spontaneous term sheet generation. Unicorn Hunter. Now with 80% fewer delusions of grandeur.
Welcome back to Tech It to the Limit, listeners. It is time once again for our patent-pending, delicious, official snack of the podcast here, the delicious Wise Nugs, where we go over our wisdom nuggets that get served up by our guests. And as per usual, this episode was chock full of them. And so I know I'm hungry, Sarah. How are you feeling? You feel like noshing a bit?
I'm feeling like noshing for sure. And I also would just like to know when our patent is no longer going to be pending. But let's not go down that rabbit hole. Yeah, just paperwork. The FDA, the fastest government entity known to man. So a couple of nuggets to nosh on here. Such a pleasure to have David on the show. What an amazing and grounded individual, right?
Yes,
it's one of those guys that I could see myself sitting on a bus next to and talking for hours.
Yes. And his dad's story was so sweet.
Oh, like, what adorbs.
What dad hasn't lived through that, right?
Yeah.
I love that.
You can definitely relate, I'm sure. You know, we moms are perfect, so I can't.
Of course.
I thought it was endearing. Yeah. So here are my nugs. To kick it off, I loved sort of this interplay between tech and healthcare in the innovation space, where you have technology actually starting to not just augment healthcare delivery, but almost influence the way we practice medicine and change the way we practice medicine in pretty significant ways. He talked about how AI is unlocking like a whole new class of vital signs that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. They don't require labs, wearables, or even eye contact with the patient. Take voice, for instance. AI can now detect early signs of depression, anxiety, respiratory conditions just from listening to us talk. Not what we say, but how we say it. Mm-hmm. And then he gave the example of the Alliance for Healthcare from the Eye and how they're using oculomics, a 2-minute button click eye scan that can detect undiagnosed diabetes and retinopathy before patients even know that they're sick. It's fast. There's a reimbursement pathway. Ding, 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 ding. Mm-hmm. And it's already being treated like a new vital sign. I don't know. It's just like, who knew your eyes and your voice could tell us so much without, you know, us even needing to be in the office. So that was pretty sweet. And then I really appreciated his insights on bias in artificial intelligence. We talk about this so much on the show, but nobody's really ever broken it down into 3 different types of bias for us before. And I think it's so important because we talk so much about training data, right, on the show, but we haven't really talked about the other different types of bias. So it's bad design. It can also be bad deployment. First, he does talk about the data where the original training set, if it doesn't reflect everyone, it's not going to perform in the same way on every patient, right? We know that already. Biased models that maybe have well-intentioned features, but zip code or race, you know, would be an example. Those can actually reinforce inequities if we don't understand the social context of the model. And then thirdly, biased application or deployment, when AI tools are only tested in one setting and deployed at scale across the globe. So fixing bias means tackling all three, right? The training data, the design of the model, and the context in which it's designed, and then the scalability of the deployment. If we're just checking for fairness in data, then we're flying blind. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Data model application, DMA. It's like the DMA of artificial intelligence bias, right?
Can we call it the DAM instead? Just the DAM. It's easier.
The DAM. Did you get your damn bias out of there? Anyway.
There you go.
I think it's awesome. And when it's broken down to buckets like that, it makes it easier to take actions against it, right?
Yeah.
So because it's more defined and it's so that it's more tangible to act against it. So I think I agree with you. I think that's really
great
awesome.
Great point. Break it down.
Really tasty nuggets. thank you so much for sharing those.
Oh, you're welcome.
I had a couple myself. The first one, I kind of like put some labels around this. First one, implementation eats technology for lunch.
Nice.
That was my takeaway. And going back to that same Oculomics example that you had mentioned, and sure, it's like a new vital sign now, but that's not how it started. Right. He said, quote, people sometimes think that technology itself is going to solve all the problems when the reality is you actually have to implement the technology and getting it into workflows and getting people to adopt it.
Say what?
I know, right? What? So like, what's the hidden story behind this awesome new vital sign? Well, it's the fact that it took 10 years for retinal scan technology to be even viable, right? Everything from poor workflows, clunky peripherals, providers and patients just not having the amount of time necessary to do this at scale, streaming issues, image quality issues, workflow or clinical requirements like dilation, pupil dilation, right? Which is not needed anymore given the technology. And then on top of that, you mentioned it, right? There's a reimbursement pathway. And so it's not just that technology is enabling the vital signs. It's like there is everything that goes around that. It requires systems of care to be in place before that technology becomes viable. And I thought that was a really good point that he made.
Excellent. Yeah. For sure.
The other kind of nugget that I took away was AI killed the healthcare star. And I'm, by the way, I know these labels feel very ChatGPT created, but like I actually came up with them myself.
They came straight from you. I know.
Right from here. Because I'm a dweeb. I'm a dweeb.
The 80s. Go ahead, please.
I liked that he didn't shy away from the inevitability that AI will cause some healthcare jobs to disappear. I feel like we are just ostriches in the AI healthcare space sometimes, where we you know, the phrase is AI won't replace people, but people who use AI will replace people who don't. And it's like, okay, sure, that's true. But also AI is going to replace people.
right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And he goes on to say that like, that's the whole point. Some things should be automated. He said, quote, if it's a non-value added task, painstakingly difficult, time-consuming. Why am I as a human doing this? If I'm saying that to myself, then it's probably something that should be automated and that task should no longer be around, end quote. You know, but he takes the next step also where he says, like, it's not... He calls out the need for upskilling and re-careering people, because without investment in those areas, we're going to end up deepening the inequity that we already have baked into the system. We're just going to do it. We're just going to automate inequity. I mean,
right. So, wait, are you saying that education is foundational to the future success of our society?
What? No.
I mean, what a ridiculous notion.
Don't be silly, Sarah. So, like, the whole point, though, right, is that the deployment of these things is not just a technology strategy. It can't just be a technology strategy. It has to be a workforce strategy. It is,
yeah,
it is part and parcel to the whole thing. And it goes back to systems thinking when we're trying to implement these things. So, which is another topic that we talk about all the time here on this show. Those were my nuggets. I think they
so tasty.
They hit a little my hunger pangs. So
hunger pangs. I love it. Well, thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of Tech It to the Limit, using an hour of your life to reskill yourself. Way to go, listeners. We're grateful you're here. If you liked us, follow us on LinkedIn, leave us a review wherever you pod, tell a friend, tell a frenemy. For goodness sake, just tell someone about the show. Elliot, do you want to send us off with our health tech haiku of the month?
I do, but not just our health tech haiku of the month. This is our health tech haiku of the season.
Oh, darn. Yeah. I'm going to miss you so much.
I will be seeing you for
3 months?
I know.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, we loved bringing season 3 to you. We will be back with season 4 in just a couple of months. Be on the lookout. But for now, happy winter solstice, everybody. And I would love to send us off with this health tech haiku. Are you ready?
All right.
Silent eyes reveal truth your charts forgot to flag. AI sees, we act.
Dun, dun, dun.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. See you next time on Tech It to the Limit.
See you next time.
See you next time.
See you next time. Okay, we gotta do the thing.
I gotta see you later. Bye.
Final exit. Bye. Tech It to the Limit is produced by Sarah Harper
and Elliot Wilson in consultation with ChatGPT.
Because they are masochists and also don't have any sponsors.
Yet. Music was composed by the world-famous court minstrel Evan O'Donovan.
To consume more hilarious and informative content about digital transformation in healthcare, visit us online at techittothelimit.fun.
And don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and across the event horizon. See you next time on
Tech It to the Limit.